Okay, thank you. It's good to be here after 11 years, I think, since the last neutrino program that some of you remember. Okay, so the topic is neutrinos from the Fermi bubbles and the ice cube data. So this is a mix of slides and blackboard. So to have a faster start, I already have written here the main points of my talk. So of course I will give an introduction and I will mention what the Fermi bubbles are. And then try to connect them with the ice cube data, the current data that we already have, and also, of course, what possible future, future data at ice cube could possibly tell us about the Fermi bubbles. So you will see a plot of the ice cube data and with the Fermi bubbles superimposed to have an idea if ice cube might be already observing the Fermi bubbles, and then I will go over the model that predicts the Fermi bubbles as a neutrino source. That's of course a hadronic model that predicts a gamma ray and neutrino flux as a counterpart. And then ultimately my result will be a plot with the predicted event rates at ice cube for different parameters of the model, so then you will have an idea what to expect when we have higher statistics at ice cube, and hopefully there will be some discussion at the end on this. So I have prepared a very minimal list of references on that side. I hope you can read them. Most of the content of my talk will be from this paper from this year that I made in collaboration with Subur Zak, Chris Teodoso, and Lily Yang. The last two are my former students. Both of them have graduated. And then there is another paper that I have with Subur Zak that is the first quantitative prediction of the neutrino flux from the Fermi bubbles. And then the third paper, Sue Slatier and Finkbeiner, is the paper where the Fermi bubbles were presented for the first time. That's the discovery paper that came analyzing the Fermilat data. So the Fermi bubbles were seen in gamma rays, and that's the first paper about it. And then Crocker and Haronian, the fourth reference in the list, is a detailed discussion of the hadronic model of the Fermi bubbles to explain the gamma rays that we see from these objects. And at the very end of the paper, they mention a couple of lines that this could, this hadronic model also predicts neutrinos. So they mention there very briefly. And then my paper with Subur Zak gives the detail of that. And then, of course, the last two papers, Artsen et al., are the ice cube papers. The science paper is the one with 28 events, 2 years running time, and then the PRL of earlier this year is the one with 37 events. And my paper, because it's prior to the PRL ice cube paper, our paper is about the 28 events. So we don't have the update for the 37 events, okay? Okay, so brief introduction. You all probably remember by now, after seeing it so many times, the figure of the ice cube data plotted in the sky. So they plot in galactic coordinates or equatorial coordinates of the position of the various ice cube events. And so they look reasonably uniform in the distribution, but of course several people have discussed possible local sources that could contribute to part of these events. The most attention has been drawn to a non-significant excess near the galactic center, which if substantiated would make sense, because of course there's a lot of activity near the galactic center that could give high energy neutrinos. And the Fermi bubbles is one of them. So the Fermi bubbles, let me tell you what they are briefly, and then I will go in more details when I talk about the hadronic model. The Fermi bubbles are a galactic source. They are a newly discovered structure of our galaxy. So imagine the galactic disk the galactic plane with the galactic center in the middle. So the Fermi bubbles are two large spheroids that protrude out of the galactic plane on the two symmetric sides of the plane out of the galactic center. And they are very big. So imagine these two spheres that radiating gamma rays. And each of them is about 10 kiloparsecs of diameter, with 10 kiloparsecs being the scale of our galaxy. The radius of our galaxy is about that much. So these structures are as big, roughly speaking, as the galaxy itself. Okay? And
so a picture by accident the gamma rays?
I have a picture, yeah, I could show it. I wasn't planning to show it, but I could maybe, yeah, maybe I'll find it. In galactic coordinates, I don't remember. In equatorial coordinates, about 30 degrees. I have a plot that shows the Fermi bubbles. It's not the real plot. It's not the gamma ray plot, but it's kind of a...
I mean, I know what it looks like, but just for
you. Yeah. I have a plot. I'll show it. So maybe I can already erase here because I need to use the board. Because I want to give some basic facts about the bubbles before I show them. So as I said, they are very large, each of them diameter of about 10 kiloparsecs. And then the flux in gamma rays has been seen at energies between 1 and 500 GeV. And 500 GeV is as high as Fermilat goes. So that's the sensitivity of the instrument. And they have a hard spectrum. So the flux in gamma rays has the typical e to the minus 2 form. So, and in terms of normalization, it's a few 10 to the minus 10 in the usual units, which is GeV per square centimeter per second per steradian. Okay. And so this expression means that the flux goes roughly like e to the minus 2. Okay. So interestingly, soon after these objects were discovered in gamma rays, it was realized that they were probably being seen before because they correlate spatially with two other observations. One is the so-called WMAP haze, microwave excess near the galactic center. And then the other one is X-ray observation from ROSAT. And then now there are other X-ray observations of these objects as well. From one of them is from MAXI, I think it's called. It's a Japanese experiment. So, but those were prior. ROSAT and WMAP were prior. And so after seeing them in gamma rays, now we have this hypothesis of whether this question of whether those three different observations, microwave, X-ray, and gamma rays, refer to the same object. Okay, the Fermi bubbles.
So this was published by Finkbeiner and company from Harvard Smithsonian Observatory, not by the Fermi people who actually got the data, which is slightly ironic.
That's
but
true.
I remember not in the succeeding time to when it was published, there was a lot of criticism by people saying, questioning as to whether it was real or not. And I haven't followed that controversy over time. What is the status now of whether people believe this was real or simply tricks of the way they projected it?
Well, I think nowadays is pretty substantiated. There are follow-up papers, and I think now there are papers by the Fermilat collaboration that talk about this, and there are new data. So I'm saying 1 to 500 GeV because that's the latest data. The early data in the Suess, Leiter, Finkbeiner paper only stretched to 100 GeV. So then there are new data, there is a new data set on that going to 500 GeV. So they are working on it, and I think nowadays it's pretty established that these things are real.
John, I think the controversy was whether it was caused by dark matter.
Well, there was that. That's a different controversy. The first controversy was whether it existed. And also there was the question of whether it's always drawn in these pictures as having a sharp boundary.
Yes. Yes,
want to comment on that?
Yeah, I forgot to say that they, it looks like, I can fix that quickly. Maybe I can move it up. No, I cannot move it up.
This needs to be slightly.
So the plot is cut. I wonder if there is a way to fix
this
that.
This needs to be slightly adjusted.
But I don't think it has to do.
It looks like it's the projector.
Yeah, this is it yours?
Yes, that's mine. okay, I can. We can probably live with this. I can tell you what's in here. But just to finish, there has been many suggestions on what this Fermi bubbles could be due to, and dark matter was one that have been discussed.
But so unlikely that it's dark matter because of the sharp boundary.
We're talking about the sharp boundary. Yes, they have a sharp boundary, and I wasn't anticipating to talk about that, but I have figures that show this. And then another interesting feature, since we're talking about that, they have a uniform surface brightness, which is kind of difficult to explain. Uniform surface brightness means that every point, this is how they look like, so every point is equally bright, and that's possible to explain. The Crocker-Haronian paper mentions how to explain that, but it's not extremely easy to
use. What is plotted there?
So this plot, okay, let's come to this plot. So this is, these are the ice cube data, the 28 ice cube data, plotted in equatorial coordinates. So this is the sky. This is the equator. This is the declination, so negative means that's the southern hemisphere. And this is the right ascension, so this is the azimuthal angle that we are all familiar with.
And the purple?
The purple is the Fermi bubbles. This is how they look like in equatorial coordinates.
What does it mean? What is the relative?
Right, so I'm going to talk about that. So these are neutrino data. These are the track events, the crosses, and these I have. And then the red ones are shower events. So shower events have an error which is substantial. The typical size of the error is 15 degrees from the reconstruction of the position at ice cube. And instead, track events have a very small error, less than 1 degree. So this is the positional error of each event. Okay. Some of them have a very large error, like this one. And
why are the blue bubbles in the southern hemisphere?
Because this is where the galactic center is. So the galactic center is at minus 27 or 28 degrees south in equatorial coordinates. And so the Fermi bubbles, the galactic plane is.
Yeah.
It looks like this. And so the Fermi bubbles are on each side of the galactic center, which is here. They subtend an angle of about 0.8 steradians, which is pretty large. So the reason I'm showing this is because we may want to wonder if the Fermi bubbles are a source of neutrinos. Okay, so then you may want to see if some of the ice cube events correlate with that.
So what's the point that only some of the ice cube events are supposed to be associated with the Fermi bubble? Because
mm-hmm.
if I look at that, it looks like they have no association at all.
Okay, so let's look at that. So first of all, I skipped some important step. Why we even think that the Fermi bubbles should emit neutrinos. I was saying that they were discovered in gamma rays, and then there are two hypotheses when we talk, when we talk about gamma ray sources. The origin of these gamma rays could be leptonic, so there could be a mechanism that accelerates electrons, and these electrons would scatter on background photons, and what we see in this framework is upscattered photons from this process. So that's one possible explanation. And the accelerated electrons could come from the activity of the galactic center. There is a massive black hole there that could produce shocks and accelerate electrons. The other possibility is that we could have a hadronic origin of the gamma rays, which means pion decay from proton-proton collision. We could have some hydrogen gas, we could have accelerated protons at high energy, PeV or so, and then these proton-proton collisions would generate pions that would generate gamma rays. In this second framework, clearly, we should also expect charged pions and therefore neutrinos. So that's the usual connection between gamma rays and neutrinos that we expect whenever we have the baryonic or hadronic mechanism for gamma rays. So having said that, let's look here. Let's see what if there is correlation. Clearly, we're talking about only a subset of events that could possibly correlate. If you look carefully, I know it's difficult because of all the error bars, but we looked carefully and we found that there are four events that strongly correlate. And by strongly correlate, I mean that the central value is within the Fermi bubble shape. Okay, so there are four of them, and then if we go beyond that and we look at weakly correlated events, meaning that they overlap but only within the error bar, then there are four more. So it's eight events overall that correlate to some degree with the Fermi bubble.
But very bad question, Cecilia.
Yeah.
So the big blob has four of the events centered within it. Mm-hmm. The little blob has basically number 14 at the very edge.
Of number 17.
Into it. So one of them contradicts the other almost completely. And for a naive person who doesn't know much about the field, how would you explain that?
So you're saying how come we have many more events that correlate with the
southern bubbles?
Yeah,
when you draw the correlation with one of the bubbles and you say this is a very large size thing, you should have seen some in the other,
right.
But in the other you have nothing. Or one at the edge, sorry, not nothing, one at the edge, and then within very large error bars, which I believe are at...
We noticed that, so, and that's why we are not really taking this seriously. We are just, this is kind of a way to get you interested somehow in this problem. Okay, but yeah, we noticed that, and it could very well be that these events are due to something else, or some of them could be due to the galactic center, which itself could be a source of neutrinos. So this one, I added it by hand on top of the figure. It's event number 36 of the new data batch, the one that came out after we finished this paper. So there are, they went from 28 to 37 events. Out of the new events, only one correlates. That's number 36 right here.
What's the solid angle coverage of the Fermi bubbles, just to estimate the background?
What's that?
The solid angle coverage.
It's 0.8 steradians.
So that would be about 10% or so?
Yeah,
so
10%.
It should also be like one or two background events probably coming from this direction.
Yeah.
So how power law is the power law for that emission? Is it 10 to the minus 2 with good accuracy?
If we look at the gamma rays events, they are fit by a range of values for the power. They are fit by minus 2.3 as well as minus 2. So there is a range, yeah. And I'm going to show results for a range of powers.
No, because, you know, then the question is, if you have an accelerator, a Fermi accelerator that does 10 to the minus 2,
mm-hmm.
then you do collisions, then you have some expectation for what your pion decay spectrum should look like.
Right.
Am I gaining ahead of myself?
You are, yeah. That's what I'm getting at. This is not the whole of my talk.
Sorry.
There is more.
I think we should let her move on.
Yeah. Okay, so this is as much as I wanted to say about this figure. And then probably the next figure is already the spectrum. So let me go over the details of the hadronic model, which is the one we use to calculate the spectrum. And then I have the figure for that. So as I said, if we believe that the origin of the gamma rays is hadronic, we need we need proton-proton collisions, and so we need a background gas, and we need injection of high-energy protons. So let's start with the background gas. Most likely it's hydrogen. That's a very reasonable assumption, okay? And so why should we have hydrogen protruding out of the galactic center, forming these bubbles? Well, the idea is that there is such a thing as a galactic wind. So there is a galactic wind produced by star formation. Forming stars produce a wind of protons, which are then funneled towards the galactic center. So the way I think about it, I'm not sure if it's completely correct, but I think it is in the essence. So there is this galactic wind, and it's kind of channeled through to the galactic center, and then it kind of stays there and grows, forming these spherical structures. So
assuming a dipolar magnetic field for the galaxy.
Magnetization is probably in a disk, right? And disks need to jets very generically, so.
Because there is a question of starburst, right? Starburst activity, right? Starburst-driven wind.
Starburst-driven wind, yeah. So there is this wind that in this framework is responsible for forming the background gas in the bubbles.
So the question is again the sharp cutoff. Then I mean, how do you explain the sharp cutoff if you have this kind of wind? Because it can only be explained if you have an onset. Let's say you switch on the wind and then it's diffusing out there, and then you have the shock.
We have shock. Right? We have shock.
You could have a shock, right?
We have shock.
We have a shock. Yes. But this wouldn't have this kind of spherical shape when you.
If you have a shock or a bubble of magnetic fields, no, which is being blown up, then you would expect. No? Depends on what the diffusion timescale is. No?
Yeah, but it's like a temporary structure to some degree. I mean, we wouldn't see the temporary dependence because it's in a long time scale.
Yeah, the wrong time scale.
Yeah.
So you're assuming a sort of shell versus a volume, right?
We are not, for what we are doing, we are not assuming what the 3D structure of the Fermi bubbles is, because essentially, as you will see in a moment, we are taking the observed gamma ray spectrum, and we are saying that the neutrinos should trace the observed gamma ray spectrum. So in some sense, how the gas is distributed in the 3D structure of the bubbles is something that we don't need.
The brightness you say is uniform, which
yeah.
is kind of surprising. Now, if you have a bubble, then there is different thickness.
Yeah,
these
exactly.
are optically
yeah,
thin,
yeah.
right? The bubbles.
Certainly. I would say, yeah.
So
yeah, it's that particular aspect is not easy to explain. Mm-hmm. So if you want to explain it, you have to assume a non-trivial distribution of the gas, indeed, with more at the edge and less at the center. In the Crocker and Aronian paper, they discuss this. A little, and they say that you can explain it thinking that proton-proton could be, they say that in their model, proton-proton collision is the main source of energy loss, it's the main source of cooling of this gas. And so they say that if you start with a more dense gas in the center of the bubbles, then you have more collisions and more cooling. And then this tends to uniform over time, tends to uniform the distribution, and perhaps even deplete the center of the bubbles. But this is something that, honestly, I haven't looked into, and I wouldn't know how to plausibly explain that. Yeah, so it's kind of an open question at this point.
Are you interested in protons or hydrogen? Hydrogen you can probe by 21 centimeters. So is it protons? I mean, stripped hydrogen.
I believe it's just protons. Yeah, it's not. I don't think it's atomic hydrogen. Yeah, it's a wind. So I don't think.
It's still 21 centimeters.
So according, if we believe that the Rosette X-ray data refer indeed to these objects because they are spatially correlated with that, the data indicate a density of this gas of the order of 10^-2. Centimeters to the minus 3. And then another interesting
sorry, that's the
of the gas, yeah. And then in, again, in the Crocker and Haronian paper, they discuss that they assume that the bubbles are in a steady state. So they have been there long enough to reach a steady state. And they conclude that in this scenario, the injection of this gas through the wind due to star formation has to have occurred over a time scale of 10 to the 9 years, billion years. So essentially, in order to reach a steady, because this is the cooling time, this is roughly the cooling time scale of these protons. So they say that in order to reach a steady state, there has to be a star formation activity going on in the galaxy for about a billion years, which apparently is longer than most galactic models predict. So this is one big assumption that we could test with neutrinos. If we see neutrinos from the Fermi bubbles, that would be a confirmation of the hadronic model, and it would indicate a billion-year time scale of star formation near the galactic center to explain this. So then we need a background gas, but we also need injection of high-energy protons to have the collisions. So where could these protons come from? They could come from supernova remnants, which are a candidate source for high-energy cosmic rays, or PV scale or so. So the idea is that near the galactic center, there should be a population of supernova remnants that produce high-energy protons. And through the same galactic wind that I mentioned a moment ago, these protons could also end up there and fill the bubbles and ultimately illuminate them so they become bright in gamma rays. So at this point,
probably yet, like, why not have accretion a billion years ago on the central black hole that results in a jet that then you no longer see the accretion, but you see the bubble, but the cooling time is so long. Right, that this could be an event that you no longer see in the galactic center.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think
there are
several explanations. This is one of them, but there are other explanations that hypothesize exactly that. Okay. Yeah, maybe a past event due to the galactic center black hole producing some sort of jet.
I thought the complaint was that it's not accreting very much at all now.
Right. Yeah.
So
there has to be a past activity stronger than the current activity to explain this. Yeah, that's one of the scenarios that have been proposed. Yeah.
So I think what's been confusing me is that the density of 10 to the minus 2 is typical, maybe even small, for the galactic plane. But you're really interested in 10 kiloparsecs away from the plane.
Right.
So that's what the issue is. How do you get gas up there?
Yeah. Well, again, this comes from the ROSAT X-ray data. So they see X-rays and they infer that more.
Suggest to know what the barrier is, a few times 10 to the minus 3.
Yeah, so we talked with Kota earlier today. And nowadays, with more data, the estimate has gone down a bit. It's okay. half that.
So
between 10 to the minus 3 and 10 to the minus 2. Yeah.
So this is projected, right? So truly, you don't know what the density distribution is.
Right.
But
this is sort of integrated average, yeah, some average, yeah.
Like, so it could be a bubble where.
Yeah, there could be.
Sides are hot and dense because there's a shock and so forth.
Okay. Yeah, there could be an interesting geometry. Yeah. So I was talking about supernova remnants. So you're probably thinking about the Hillas plot. How high energy can we reach with supernova remnants as accelerators? So let me remind you what the Hillas criterion is. So the idea is that if you have, you need a magnetic field to have Fermi accelerations. And the Hillas criterion is that you can reach a maximum energy E0, which comes from essentially assuming that the Larmor radius of your particles is smaller than the size of the object. So the E0 comes out to be 1 PeV for an object of a 1 parsec size and a magnetic field of 1 microgauss. And these parameters, I picked these parameters because these are believed to be typical of supernova remnants. So for supernova remnants, maybe you can tweak the parameters a little bit, but we are talking about a maximum energy of 110 PeV or so. So that's the scale. So given this, then Fermi acceleration predicts that the proton spectrum, the spectrum of the primary protons, should have roughly a form of e to the minus 2. So we should have e to the minus k, and k will be around 2, but I will show different values for this. And then there should be a cutoff around this energy, which is expressed by an exponential, e over e zero. Okay. So this is what we assume as primary proton spectrum in the Fermi bubbles. There is a bit of a catch because this is what is predicted from acceleration in supernova remnants. But then you may wonder, well, these protons ultimately end up in the bubbles. So how do we know how the spectrum change from when they are produced to when they end up in the bubbles? So this is addressed in the Crocker and Aronian paper, and they say that the key point is saturation. Saturation means that these protons end up in the bubbles, and they have to stay there long enough. They have to become trapped there, so they have to have an escape time, which is much longer than the cooling time. So T cooling, much longer than T escape. In this way, they become trapped, and this ensures that they inherit the produced spectrum. So we can take the spectrum at production to be the spectrum in the bubbles. Okay. And then we can take the spectrum and we can calculate the spectrum will produce gamma rays and neutrinos, which is my next figure. But before I go to the figure, I can show roughly how the spectrum looks like, because if you're willing to do some approximations, you can give us some analytical description of it. So,
but the cooling, if you are talking about steady state, then it's something else than if you just spit it out, right? So the cooling is energy dependent, right? So then if you feed a certain input spectrum and you have a cooling which is better at some energies than at other energies,
right,
you're talking about steady state, and you're not going to settle to the injected spectrum. You're going to settle to some other spectrum, which is, I mean, can you distinguish these models that you have continuous injection versus, you know, old injection that's...
I would say if you have an episodic injection, then your spectrum will change. It will degrade and become colder and so on. If you have a steady state, then the assumption is that the protons that you lose are either due to escape or to cooling are constantly replenished by the protons that are coming in.
But you see what I'm saying? If you have a steady state and you have more energy loss at high energies.
As in the leaky box.
Yes.
Right.
Then gives you your net steady state is not the injected spectrum, it's something else.
Right.
So, so then the question is, what is that something else? And can you tell?
Right. So, the I think a large part of the Crocker and Haronian paper addresses just that. And I have to admit that I didn't understand it completely. But they say that as long as they seem to say that the key point is the escape. Mm-hmm. If these protons can escape, and what is the time scale of escape? If they are trapped, sufficiently trapped, then they conclude that they inherit the spectrum, the injected spectrum is inherited by the population of the protons in the bubbles. But this is not something that I fully
even if the cooling time scale is lower than the dynamic injection time scale, in this case, the important cooling process is adiabatic velocity and PV cooling. And this cooling process is almost energy independent.
Yeah, so the only way that you would preserve it is if it is energy independent.
Yes, that's the way, you know, the combined spectrum of the combined cosmic rays is similar to the spectrum injected from a cosmic ray.
Yeah, so the thing is confined.
Like the escape time scale also has to be.
Because I'm talking about cosmic rays with energy, the new ones that escape energies. Yes, so, you know, for the, as long as the energy is lower than the escape, you know, the critical energy where the escape time is comparable to the injection time, then I can say that, you know, spectrum is similar to the injected spectrum in this sense.
But I mean, your cooling is by proton-proton collisions. You're saying that there is the same cross section, or
yeah, of course, it's yet some dependence.
There should be between
yes, but the
1 GeV
yes.
and 500 GeV.
Yes,
I would expect quite a bit of dependence.
Yes.
Okay, so let me write the last set of formula that I have, and then everything else is figures. So. So we use the Sybille code to calculate the flux of gamma rays and the flux of neutrinos, starting with that injection spectrum for protons, assuming proton-proton collisions with that density of the gas. What? That's my next step. It's a bit of an overkill, even though we have done that. It's a bit of an overkill because you can do something simpler. And this is, for example, a good approximation. You get something like, and then I'm going to write it, and then I'm going to explain. So this is for gamma rays. So you get something like 2NH divided by 4 pi d squared, where d is the distance to the Fermi bubble. So this is purely geometric dilution factor. And then I have k pi, and then I have an integral with a threshold, e pi threshold, in d e pi, where e pi is obviously the pion energy. And I have the cross-section for pp collisions. And then, of course, the proton flux. And then in the denominator, I have square root of e pi squared minus m pi squared, which is obviously the momentum of the proton. So in the denominator, I have p pi, the momentum of the pion. Okay, so this is obtained under an approximation which is called the delta function approximation, because it assumes that the pions inherit a fixed fraction of the energy of the parent proton. This is an approximation, but it's reasonable to use. And then this factor, all the factors are reasonably intuitive. This factor is the distribution of energies of the photons produced by a pion of fixed energy. This is what it is. And then just to complete the picture, I have that the proton energy and the pion energy are related as follows by this k pi factor. So it's e pi over k pi plus the proton mass. So k pi is the fraction of kinetic energy of the proton that goes into the pion, and k pi, I think the value that best reproduces the spectrum, I think, is 0.17. And then the threshold comes just from kinematics. Energy threshold for pion production can be expressed in terms of the gamma ray energy as follows. Okay. But you don't have to worry about this. This is just to say that it's not too difficult to calculate the spectrum, and a similar expression is valid for neutrinos.
Are you using Sybille directly?
What?
Are you using Sybille code directly? Or?
No, we are using, Subur did this, and he used phenomenological fit.
Yeah, this is what I mean. This is the typical approach I would be doing. There's a paper by K9 Union in 2006.
That's the one, yeah. So we didn't use this analytical form. We used a fit to Sybille.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so now I have the figure. Finally, you see some results. Okay, so this is energy. Okay, this is energy in GeV. And this is the calculated neutrino spectrum normalized to the gamma ray spectrum observed. So this is normalized to the observed gamma ray flux that we see from the Fermi bubbles. This K is the power. This K is the power here in the proton spectrum. So this is for a K equal to 2.1, and this is K equal to 2.3. So you can see the Fermi data, you will see them in a moment. The Fermi data are compatible with both, but clearly at high energy there is a big difference, obviously. And then what do we have here? We have these lines refer to different values of the cutoff, E0. So we have taken 1 PV, 3, 10, and 30 PV cutoff. Okay, and the same here. 1, 3, 10, 30. And then what we have here, this is the atmospheric neutrino flux. So you can see at some point beyond a certain energy, the Fermi bubble flux will be above the atmospheric flux, which is good because this is background. And then this is the Antares limit. So Antares is a small experiment, but they were looking for the Fermi bubbles and in neutrinos. They didn't see anything, and they put an upper limit. And this, finally, this line is the ice cube best fit flux is around the Waxman-Bacall bound. It's a few 10 to the minus 8 in these units. So I just want to clarify that this is the fit to the ice cube data, assuming that all of them come from a uniform distribution. Okay.
I'm a little puzzled. So at 10 to the 5, the atmospheric should completely dominate? Well, why doesn't ice cube see them?
So this is 10 to the 5 GeV, so it's 100 TeV. It's 100 TeV. So at 100 TeV, we have, this is the atmospheric flux.
Yes.
And this is the Fermi bubble flux. And you're saying, why isn't ice cube observing the Fermi bubbles? Or?
Which point, show me where the ice cube fit is. Maybe I'm not seeing. Yeah. So it looks like at about 10 to the 5 or a little bit lower, you should see an enormous flux from the atmosphere.
Right.
But ice cube doesn't see it?
Well, ice cube has an atmospheric veto. They can veto the atmospheric neutrinos.
The ice cube best fit to the bubble.
No. This is.
Then I don't understand that. Why isn't ice cube seeing the blue line? The dot dashed line.
They do see them.
That's the only thing they see. The two lines.
They do. You were saying something, Kota?
Because they see, but they can still find the signal using veto.
They veto atmospheric neutrinos. They have a veto that allows them to identify an atmospheric neutrino.
Okay.
And the way they do that is because at these energies, they can see both the neutrino and the accompanying muon. They see the muon in the outer veto, and then they see the neutrino, and if the tracks correlate, they exclude them. Yeah, this is a subtle point. So it was. I'm glad you asked because I would have forgotten to mention otherwise.
So Cecilia, if you're seeing something from the Fermi bubble, you will like to see somewhere where the two blue lines are intersecting or
That's
something
right.
like that.
Yeah.
So now, is there any reason to believe that the ice cube data are coming from any source? Because what they say that it is uniformly distributed.
Yeah.
Is there any plausible logic to think that some of them are coming from a particular source?
They analyzed for spatial correlations, and they found that there is no evidence for any clustering of data.
Which you would expect.
Which you would expect. You would expect. Yes. So right. They have. If they have, it's non-significant. So they.
So more data,
but the statistics are so low.
But the statistics
doesn't disallow it either.
Exactly.
More data.
But in the case that they come from the Fermi bubble, how correlated with the Fermi bubble that would be? I mean, could you still have events come from somewhere else, or? And I just want to understand how strongly would be the space correlation if in your model.
Well, neutrinos should come from those purple regions that you have seen, and then there is the error the positional error of the detector, which is about 15 degrees. So you should see a blurred picture. If you look at the neutrino data, they should describe a blurred picture by blurred by 15 degrees because of the experimental
error. Another live question. Yeah. You saw these two bubbles, which you said better.
Yeah.
Are those the only two regions of Fermi bubble allowed by the model theory measurement for the region? There could be other places in the last graph where it could be.
You mean if there could be other regions like the Fermi bubbles yes. elsewhere?
Yes.
I would say that it's difficult to imagine other old objects like this away from the galactic center okay, because the galactic center is where the high energy action is.
Okay.
But, yeah. So I have another version of this plot that I'm showing only because I thought you may want to see the gamma ray data. So this is how the gamma ray data look like before the latest Fermilab release. Now they extend a little further out.
I would be more interested in what the neutrino plot now tells us actually.
Yeah.
Does it, I mean, if you go back one slide, is minus 2.3 is kind of a good fit, it seems.
Yeah.
But the gamma ray data tell us something different on the K, right? So there's a discrepancy.
The gamma ray data?
What kind of spectral index do they have?
So the gamma ray data, this is the 2.1 spectrum. Mm-hmm. But if you take 2.3, it kind of looks like this.
Okay.
So it's still okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because of the large errors here.
You're right, you're right.
Yeah.
But now the Fermi found the cutoff and spectrum is actually the more kind
yes.
of high,
yes.
high spectrum.
The last Fermi data have a little lower here. So it looks like they have a hint of a cutoff around 500 GeV or so.
I mean, to me, that looks neither like e to the power of minus 2.1 or 2.3. It looks like some kind of complicated function, which I would directly take. I mean,
like some structure like this. Yeah.
Then you have some uncertainty how to extrapolate it, actually.
Yeah.
It's just large.
Oh, but such a structure is, you know, already more, not so clear, you know, gone in the data still.
It's
yeah. gone more
okay.
Okay, so now we can use these neutrino flux to predict the event rate at IceCube, and we use the effective area at IceCube that was kindly provided by Albrecht Karl and Jacob van Santen. And this is how it looks like. Unfortunately, you cannot see anything here. Let me see what this is. This is
6.3.
This is about, right, exactly. So this is, you can calibrate using this, right? So this is 10 TeV, okay? Okay, I just wanted to say here that if you have a flavor democratic flux, meaning all the flavors equally represented, you expect to have, of course, charge current interactions of muon neutrinos, which will give you tracks because you have a muon track, and then you also expect charge current and neutral current interactions of all the other flavors, and neutral current interactions of muon neutrinos. So those give you showers. So the ratio of tracks to showers is about, I think, 20% of tracks. So it's not a surprise that the IceCube data sample is dominated by showers because they only, according to this, only 20% should be.
Don't want to open this kettle today, we had it already.
What's that?
This kettle we discussed already, so we don't want to.
Okay. All right, so I can move on. Okay, so these are our results. This plot is a bit busy, I realize, but at least you can see the axis. So this is the pessimistic case of K equal to 2.3, the spectrum that falls more rapidly. And this is K 2.1. So this is the number of events expected in 10 years from the Fermi bubbles above a certain threshold. So this is the threshold starting with 10 to the 4.4. GeV. The curves you should look at is this band between the blue lines, because this is the events expected from the Fermi bubbles, inclusive of showers and tracks. And then the dashed line is what you expect, again, showers and tracks from atmospheric neutrinos in the same in the same solid angle. So we assume that you are looking at that solid angle, and you're looking at whatever comes at you from that two purple regions. And of course, some of them will be atmospheric, some of them would be perhaps on the Fermi bubbles. And so this is how they compare. So in this case, they are sort of comparable here. Perhaps if you go to higher energy, you can still see something from the Fermi bubbles, but the event rate will be very low. And then here, instead, it's more optimistic. So here we are talking about 20, 25 events per year, much more than atmospheric. The band, the width of the band is due to varying E0, the cutoff of the proton spectrum from 1 to 30 PeV. No, I haven't shown that yet. That's my next slide.
The red curve is that was my interpretation.
Which curve?
The red curve. Keep going. This.
Okay.
Much larger than the rest you see.
Unless you put the cutoff.
So are you looking here and you're saying, well, this flux is higher?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, this flux is higher. Yeah.
Much higher.
Yeah. So yeah, we predict an excess over the diffuse uniform flux, and because the statistics is low, it will be with the current data it will be a no significant effect. But then with more data, it should be significant. Yeah, so we predict that.
Number of events is probably not so different, right? Number of events.
So maybe I can go to the next slide.
2.1 is consistent with the Fermi data.
Yeah. Yeah.
With the Fermi data.
The latest one. I think the 2.1 that overshoots many data points, especially around the cutoff. Latest one.
This one?
Yeah, no, the latest one.
Latest one. Yeah.
Yes, and then they have more smaller error than 2.1
is certainly disfavored by the new Fermi. Unfortunately, I don't have the figure for the new Fermi. I could find.
2.3.
2.3 is probably.
2.3 also disfavored, I think, as far as I checked.
So then,
no, I don't think so.
Yeah, I did, because I'm.
So what kind of K power is being favored?
It's steeper than 2.3.
It's steeper than 2.3.
No, I think
2.2, I had a problem,
Okay, so I don't know, I have no idea what time it is, but if there is enough time, I can find that figure. Or maybe you can find it, Kota, and we can show it.
I have it.
You have it? Okay. Okay. So how about this? I can go to our prediction, and then we can look at that figure.
But one of the key, I don't know anything about this, but one of the key physics points seem to me that you are relying on extrapolating things on the power law for several orders of magnitude, right? Because your neutrinos are at the PeV, your photons are at 100 GeV, so there is a...
Yeah.
So the statement is that you extrapolate there, and exactly how much you tilt your power spectrum could give you everything or nothing, right?
That's
the game? Okay.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
Yeah. So, right. So this is why we have these two figures, because we want to show that indeed, if this is the case, then you have very much suppressed signal from the Fermi bubbles, and you could see nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So you could still have a hadronic scenario with a colder spectrum, and then you wouldn't see the neutrinos from
right.
the Fermi.
But this is where
you point out the ice cube does fit line. I can't see a piece with the lights on.
This one, okay. So this line, I forgot to mention, this one is the ice cube best fit line. So ice cube best fit means, again, you take the diffuse flux at the level that fits the ice cube data today, assuming that all of them are due to a diffuse flux.
And so everything else, all the other curves are below that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So if you have a diffuse flux from extragalactic sources at the level that ice cube favors today, for 2.3, that wins. Yeah. Even, and this is the number, the data, the number of events expected from the diffuse flux in that solid angle. Yeah. So yeah, so here you wouldn't see anything.
And this assumes the ice cube fit they like these days, it seems, is e to the minus 2.3, but they put a cutoff in at a few PeV. So
yeah.
Whereas you're running this spectrum up to 30 PeV, I guess.
Well, 30 PeV is the cutoff of the primary proton spectrum. Then the neutrino spectrum would have a lower cutoff.
Sure.
Yeah, maybe one order of magnitude less. Yeah.
This is where, you know, the physics of cooling and steady state becomes important. So you inject a spectrum, it's a power law, let's say it's Fermi, minus two, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then in the range of energies that Fermi observes, this fact that the energy-dependent cooling may be sort of not important, or you don't see it very much. But then the key to this is extrapolating it several orders of magnitude up.
Yeah.
And then a little difference in tilt could mean life and death for this prediction. So,
that's right.
So
right.
The way things,
yeah,
in a steady state, what the spectrum is and whether it's steeper or what, mm-hmm, sounds like it's the...
It's important.
It's the,
but if the cooling, as long as the cooling time is shorter than the injection time, the neutrino spectrum should rise the cosmic ray spectrum because, you know, yes, steady state spectrum is tilted, but on the other hand, the cross section increases the energy, it's compensated.
No, but there's a billion year time scale.
Yes,
so
it depends on the cooling time. So if the cooling time is shorter than the injection time, then it's compensated. If the cooling time is longer than the injection time, then yes, because of the cross section.
I'm not sure what you're saying, but if you inject it in one burst, mm-hmm, a billion years ago,
okay,
then you get
different.
Well, then you get one prediction, right?
Yes,
if you keep injecting with some rate and cooling, you get another prediction. And so in either case, the exact tilt that you get is the game changer here, whether, right? Because you're doing something at the PeV based on 100 GeV photon flux, or am I missing something?
I can only say that yes, we are. The neutrino signal that we predict is entirely due to an unmapped,
mm-hmm,
part of the Fermi bubble spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
So we are relying on a model.
Mm-hmm.
And I take your comment as the fact that we need to know the model very well,
right,
to be able to.
And also turn it around, you can try to fit it, and then from this you can derive your escape time scales and so on, and adjust them in a way that you fit.
You can use this as a way to probe your model.
In future super ice cube, if you identify a component that comes from the bubbles, from the direction of the bubbles, then of course you are in business.
Yeah.
But how can you know the escape time? Because we cannot discriminate between the intrinsic maximum energy and the escape time.
Mm-hmm.
Escape energy, right? It's hard.
Yeah, but I mean, at least if you have an energy-dependent component in there, you could probably somehow derive it.
Okay,
so if you allow me to show a couple more figures. So this is, we agree, I think, that the 2.3 case is pessimistic. We may never see neutrinos from the Fermi bubbles in that case. So this plot refers to the optimistic case because that's the one that can possibly give you a signal. So this is the event rate in energy beams, logarithmic energy beams, for 10 years running time. And these are not stacked histograms. Each histogram of each color, maybe I should turn off since I'm not using the blackboard anymore. So each histogram refers to, starts from here. So this is the black is atmospheric. The blue is Fermi bubbles, 1 PeV, with 1 PeV proton spectrum cutoff. And then the light color, it should be light blue, is for 3 PeV. So you see that for 1 PeV, even for 2.1, for 1 PeV, we are at the level of atmospheric flux. And then if we go to higher energy cutoff, 3 PeV or higher, then of course we are start to exceed the atmospheric background. So
just a second. This atmospheric background is without any beetle, or is it already pass after the
beetle? It is obtained using the same effective area that we are using for the signal. So we are taking the atmospheric flux and we are taking the Fermi bubble flux. We integrate them with the same effective area. So I would say probably without the veto, because then the veto...
Can you get the same atmospheric fit that Ice Cube has for the atmospheric data doing that?
With them...
Because that would tell you if you... this is working.
I would say that we are not including the fact that there is an atmospheric veto because we are using the same effective area for
signal.
So this will go down.
That should be atmospheric minimum. Like from upwards down.
Cecilia, so I'm completely lost in these two problems. Your beam size is roughly in energy in the log scale.
Right.
X axis is the same. So what you're telling me that on the left plot at the first bin you're dominated by atmospheric, fine.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that?
This one?
Yes.
Right. Yeah, pending what Renata just said, yes. this is...
So still you have the not 3 PeV, you will not see much.
Yeah.
Fine. Then in the second plot, how suddenly you expect more, and then in the third one it goes down, because if as the energy goes up, since wouldn't you be seeing less or more? That I'm a little lost.
So now you're looking here
this one.
And here.
Yes.
So this shape here. So this is 10 to the 5 GeV. So this is 100 TeV.
Yes.
So this is between, say, 100 and 500 or so.
So the rate you will expect to go down for the same energy, no?
But the effective area goes up.
So both of them are folded here?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Fine. Yes. So the atmospheric neutrino spectrum decreases faster than the Fermi bubbles.
Fine. I got it.
Yeah. So this is for 10 PeV and 30 PeV. This is 30 PeV. This is 10 PeV. So this is the best, the most optimistic case, 30 PeV, 2.1. Unlikely to be the physical one, but we get about 23, I think, 23 events from the Fermi bubbles in 10 years. To cut off before the resonance?
Yeah, 6.2.
No, perhaps the only reason is that we wanted this plot. So, we could have. No, the answer is no. we could have continued here. We didn't. We shouldn't. Now I can go on.
So these are the data points?
So these are the data points that I showed at the beginning. These are the. I need to explain how to read this figure because it's a bit complicated.
This is the neutrino energy, right? Exactly the
yes.
neutrino energy, but the data is deposit energy, right?
Yes. That's an important caveat.
Can you please explain it? X-axis is neutrino energy.
X-axis is neutrino energy in logarithmic,
fine.
In GeV. And these are the observed energies of the events that are strongly correlated and weakly correlated with the Fermi bubbles. So now this is the 662 days prediction.
Let me ask a question before you go. If I put other events on this plot, you have only put the ones which are strongly correlated.
And weakly correlated.
So the other plots, other events will not fall here.
No.
Okay.
So just one thing. I think the glacial resonance is not there. Actually, I mean, the plot doesn't even go to that because the 6.6 is 10 to the power of 6.6, and this gives you 4 PeV. So the because it's a log scale, so this is just 4 PeV still. So
right, but
then
you could not go further.
Yeah,
sure. He was asking why we didn't keep going here. So so how to read this plot? The meaning of this plot is that here in this bin right now we have 3 events. 1, 2, and 3, one of them strongly correlated. In this bin, we have currently 2 events, and 2 strongly correlated, 2 weakly correlated, and in this we have 1 strongly correlated. Back to Kota's comment, these are observed energies, And this is the measurement of the observed energy with the error bar. But of course, this is neutrino energy. So we didn't want to undertake the challenge to predict what the observed energy would be, because that's not easy. What?
The
they are all cascades. No, 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 for cascades, it's not. Yeah. So for cascades, the neutrino energy and the observed energy could be different by up to a factor of 3 to 4. And this is why we are representing these dashed lines here, because if you want to have a rough compare, and that's why we picked the beams to be so large, because we wanted to make this meaningful. So the parent neutrino that produced this event could have energy somewhere in here. Okay. So this is, we are not claiming anything about the current ice cube data. This is more of a curiosity than anything else. But I think this is interesting because it means that once we have high statistics data, we should see if under certain conditions for the parameters, we may see an excess due to the Fermi bubbles. And in particular, we expect an excess if the spectrum is hard, 2.1, and the cutoff is also reasonably high, meaning higher than 3 or so PeV.
So I'm not familiar. What will be the time frame when ice cube gets more data, 2 years, 5 years, or whatever?
Well, according to our plot, in order to get some statistics sufficient to do this, you need probably maybe at least 5 years, 5, 10 years of running. Yeah. So an interesting point also that I want to mention, and then I will probably close here, is that it's important to keep in mind that there could be local sources, even though they may not be seen at a significant level. Because if you know that some of the events are due to a local source, you know that they are not due to a diffuse flux. So the normalization of the diffuse flux will go down. Okay, so quickly, if we do a quick calculation, we have 28 events. 10 of them, more or less, are background. So let's assume we have 18 true astrophysical events. Then if 4 of them, hypothetically speaking, are from the Fermi bubbles, then this means that the diffuse flux that produces all the other events would be lower by maybe like, would be lower by what? By roughly 20% or so. So this is not, again, something to worry about with 28 or 37 data points, but at some point it may be an interesting consideration. 54 data points very soon. 54 data points very soon, yeah. So I think I will close here. I may mention some further developments that we are thinking about, but or maybe Kota can show the plot of the newest Fermi data. Depending on what the interest is. So thank you.
Maybe first of all, direct questions to the talk. Any further direct questions?
So some of the normalizations that I think you were just referring to at the end mm-hmm. are based on the assumption this is coming from the galactic center. But if it's right up against my nose, the normalization goes down orders of magnitude.
That's right.
So.
Yeah, so we are assuming that these objects are near the galactic center, so we are taking a distance of roughly 9 kiloparsecs, which is, there is this factor 1 over 4 pi d squared, so what you're saying, well, this factor could be different. But again, it would be surprising if we have something of that magnitude, which is unrelated to the galactic center.
You can also, in principle, just relate the gamma ray flux to the neutrino flux directly.
Right.
Used by the same kind of interaction, and then
right.
Yeah.
And you don't need them.
That's right.
So what we have done.
You have 4 orders of magnitude, or 3 that you extrapolate. There's no direct. So my question was, if you have this data, right?
Maybe this quota can address, because in principle we have not
yes.
You want to see?
Yeah. I mean, he wants to see. I want to ask my question. He is organizing. He's standing. So please go ahead.
No, but I think if your question is about the model, maybe.
No. The question is related to the model, but it's so if you take this power law and you extended to higher energy, which is crucial. Do you get any observable prediction for Milagro or for Hawk?
Yes.
In fact, this is something that we are doing. I wanted to mention, and you have a nice plot on that, so that's related. So yes, Hawk is probably the next wide-angle gamma ray detector that will come online. It's already functioning. For those that haven't heard about it, it's in Mexico. And it will have a very good view of the Fermi bubbles, because the Fermi bubbles are in the southern hemisphere. Hawk is about 50 degrees opening angle, so they will be... The Fermi bubbles will be in their field of view for us.
About Milagro, they're not in the field of view, or?
Milagro.
Because you already have data for that.
It doesn't work.
Oh, that one.
No, you cannot.
The mine wouldn't work for you.
You can just turn it around. Yes.
I have your paper. I have your paper, Kota.
Full page board.
I have your paper.
Yeah, maybe.
This plot.
Yes, but this is the
operated one, actually. Okay. Milagro, I don't know. I think perhaps Milagro has a few.
Milagro has data. They only two things like.
No, but they're not running for some time.
No, but they have data. So you can say now whether this is.
So this is what I can show from my device.
No, it's just
This is okay?
This is okay. Yes, this is okay. Okay, very good.
So yeah, this is without the latest.
Okay. No.
I think this is a Hawk.
That's Hawk, yeah.
Can you explain this properly that you also...
Yes, so here, just in the previous data, we try to fit the gamma data with 2.2, and then, you know, so if you are showing the PP, then you can predict the neutrino crack, because the spectrum index should be the same. Then I extrapolate it. If you don't extrapolate, I cannot extrapolate the rest of the data. Then apparently, if I use the 2.2, then I can explain the excess. By the way, this data point is obtained, and by assuming that isotropic plus Fermi bubble, the Fermi bubble can, you know, have four events. Of course, some of them should be background events.
Right, and Mr. What are you explaining now?
Oh, the, you know, how I get this point.
What is that point?
Oh, so this is the data point, assuming that the four events are associated with it.
That's the flux that you need,
you know,
to explain the Fermi bubbles.
With four events within your
Fermi bubble.
Yeah. Your Fermi bubble.
You assume that those events are found in the Fermi bubbles, that's the flux you need.
And what did you do to put in the cutoff on this guy?
In this case, I put the CPD.
So we checked it's consistent.
Then,
it's consistent with what I
showed. Hawk, so this is gamma ray detector, future gamma ray detectors. And this is the.
And there are other detectors. There is a CTA, there is. But those are more far in the future.
I'm not sure if it is realized.
But Hawk is already running.
Yes.
Yeah.
Then the is, you know, prediction is that, you know, the, if the neutrinos indeed come from Fermi bubbles, then the Hawk or other CTA also can do that. Because if CTA has a smaller field of view, then, you know, they cannot see the entire Fermi bubble.
Yeah.
However, they can see the edge.
Yeah.
Fermi bubble edge.
Yeah.
Then they can subtract the off source, and they can see the on source and off source region. In principle, they can.
So do you know about Milagro, since Alex was asking?
Yeah, Milagro region is different. Milagro point is actually, you know, can you, I think that I have a plot in the different page. But you know, the first, you know, my point is that, you know, if the neutrinos come from Fermi bubble, you know, then the gamma rays should see, the Hawk should be able to see this, and that's it.
So Hawk is mapping the higher energy region,
right.
So it will resolve the issue of the power, of the spectral index.
That's right.
Because, you know, as I said, actually, recently the Fermi bubbles, Fermi team has better data. Yeah, I think recent data, I have the curvature like this.
So if I mean now and I extrapolate this curvature, then this curve should not be linear here, but it should go like this down.
Yes, 2.2 doesn't work.
We can see it from here.
Even though Kota, gamma rays are absorbed. Gamma rays from those distances start to have some absorption.
Gamma ray absorption is important only here. Because in this case, it's NBR, or the CMB is important for gamma
rays. So if you are saying that Fermi already at the high end that drops off, that's the end of the game, no?
Well, in principle, no.
Unless it does that. Right?
No, I say that, you know, that this indeed favors the electronic scenario.
How serious is that Fermi roll-up?
This is a Japanese way to say no, right?
Yes.
But well, because you know that if you look at the literature, always now the leptonic favor, model favor, but now some people always start to think of the two component model, right?
This is a way to say very difficult, which means no, right?
But seriously speaking, those data at high energy at Fermilab, they have a large error bar. So do we have a statistical statement on how?
Yeah, they have good statistics. Yeah.
So how statistically, how disfavored is 2.1? Do they say, like, is there like a confidence level or something?
They have the data. 2.2 doesn't work.
I mean, to be honest, I'm fitting here. Power law is a low already, and it seems wrong to me. I mean, if I look at the US data, I mean, it should be a different shape.
Yes,
this
extrapolating,
which comes like
the point is you measure neutrinos there.
Probably it's a more complicated shape. Okay. So we can probably play around
but with it
and also still make it fit somehow.
Oh, okay. So if you take the takes a more complicated model, I guess it might be possible. But
I mean, you're taking just two literally in this power, right? If you look at this data,
I want to stick to the simplest model. Yeah. So, by the way, if you go to the upper page, you can see the actual Minerva point.
Which page?
I think this is the galactic point. So the next row is probably here.
Yeah. Yeah, Milagro, that's what it is, yeah.
Yes, this is Milagro point. Milagro point is the one region found in the one region of the galaxy. So this is a different region.
Okay, so I think we should probably finish here and thank Shishimi again for support. And thank you so much for taking your role.